You're listening to Face Off, episode 86, recorded September 11th, 2010. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view the show notes for this episode by going to faceoffshow.com. So we actually have a special guest on the show today, someone that we've had on the show before, and he's going to help us out again today. Eric Wendelin, thank you for coming on the show, Eric. We appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here.
So Eric, we're going to be later on, we're going to be talking about Hadoop, which is very interesting. I'm kind of excited to talk about. But before we get into that, let's get into our news and follow-ups. And our first sort of news item that we talked about is that Amazon now has micro EC2.
Yeah, so I found this and I thought it was pretty interesting. Before Amazon EC2 was kind of like for buying a kind of a dedicated server, you know, it was pretty beefy on the resources. But they came out with this micro, which is kind of like what you would expect from a small VPS, you know, like 512 megs of RAM, mm-hmm. low resources, really, really inexpensive. It's 2 cents per hour for the Linux one and 3 cents for Windows. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting because, you know, now you can use Amazon for small, medium size hosting.
Totally. I think it's really cool because, everyone likes EC2 because it's fast to spin up a new instance if you mm-hmm. need a new one. So, you know, it doesn't have to be if you're a large business and you need to spin up another large instance, you can do a bunch of much smaller ones. And, you know, it tends to be more cost prohibitive.
So I did the math and if you reserved it for an entire year, it would cost you $9.61 a month. To wow. run one of the 612 megs of RAM server. Now, that does with Amazon, you would have to buy the bandwidth via their S3
right.
and their storage, but then you would pay the cost for that.
So, Eric, do you play around with EC2 at all?
Actually, I don't really use EC2 as much as I would rather use their Elastic MapReduce.
Mm. Ah, aha.
So they have a specific one for that. I see.
Cool. All right, so Amazon is coming out with some stuff that is, you know, definitely sort of targeted more towards low cost, smaller businesses, which is cool. I have a VPS through Linode, and so this is something to check out if I can try and, you know, save some money on it. Because it, like with a lot of them, like with Linode, you know, I get a lot of bandwidth a month, mm-hmm. But I often don't come anywhere near to it because I'm right. just doing, you know, sort of static web apps, not doing sort of large content or anything that might take up the bandwidth. So this might be a way to save money if I wanted to do that.
Also, since it's on Amazon, if your site started getting really, really popular, you can just add another instance. Maybe a little bit easier than, let's say, Linode.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think Linode has like an API for me to spin up a new one or anything like that. I would have to go in and manually buy a new one. But all right, so let's get in to our geek tool of the week. So Mark and I live in Montana. Eric, you live in Colorado, so I'm sure you know that it's starting to get cold outside. Summer is looking like it's getting near an end.
I totally froze last night, so it's already cold. And it's just September.
So I found this geek tool a while ago, and I put it, you know, I sort of shoved it into our show notes for a future episode because it was the middle of summer, and it was like 90 degrees outside, and it just seemed silly to talk about it. But our geek tool this week is the Zippo Hand Warmer, and this is really cool. I think they've been around for a while, and I just didn't know about it. But what it is it's a Zippo, so it's, you know, sort of stainless steel case that you fill with butane fluid. And then you sort of light it, and I think what it does is it just slowly burns and creates heat for your hands.
So it's kind of like a Zippo with holes on the top, and you just keep it closed and hold on to it.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't get like big flame. I think right. it's what I've seen from it, you don't even really see a flame. I think it just sort of really slowly burns and smolders. And I know, like, so, I mean, Mark, you've done some, like, snowmobiling and stuff, mm-hmm. and your hands can get cold, and so you can buy, like, sort of the chemical hand warmers where it's, like, right. a bag that you shake up, and then there starts, like, a chemical reaction, but... What's cool about this is you can refill it. And I mean, I, you know, Zippo stuff is, ever since I, you know, you're a kid, it's like you, Zippo stuff has always been really cool for me anyways.
Yeah. You know, the chemical ones, you pay like $5 or something and then it's, you use it for one time and that's it. So you, yeah. you kind of like save it and be like, you know, I don't know if I want to use it yet. It's not that cold, but this thing, you know, you refill it. It's cheap enough that kind of yeah. cool.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that maybe, you know, like I may not use it like in a tent because I'm sure it's creating, you know, some CO2 or some, what's the other one that you need like detectors for in your home?
Carbon monoxide.
Carbon monoxide. Yeah, exactly. So you have your hand warmer in your tent all night and then wake up to either a pounding headache or not wake up at all. So I would be careful with that. But yeah, so, you know, I know like, so my, it's funny. I mean, I don't get very cold. I'm kind of a, you know, bigger guy with, and I just sort of tend to run really hot, so I don't get cold a lot, but, certain things as I get older, get colder a lot more, like my feet and my hands. Like it's a lot easier for my hands to get cold. I really need to wear gloves and stuff now. So if you're outside for a long time for like a, you know, if you're going to a football game or just snowmobiling or going for a walk or something, you might think about grabbing a Zippo outdoor line hand warmer to keep your hands toasty. All right, so let's get into our web apps this week. So the first web app I want to talk about is Mark and I, a lot of the times, we love the Netflix app on the Xbox 360. We watch a lot of sort of movies together because you can start a party with your Xbox friends and then watch a movie. And really what's cool about that is it gives you voice chat while you do it, but it syncs the video so that they play at the same time, which, mm-hmm. I mean, before that happened, we used to like...
All right, three, two, one.
And... Yeah, exactly. We do sort of voice chat over Xbox 360 and then open up Netflix and we'd be like, all right, hit play on 3, 2, 1. So the party really helped that. But our web app, our first web app this week called SyncTube, allows you to do that with YouTube videos.
Yeah, sometimes we're on Skype, you know, programming on AgileTask or another project, and it's like, hey, you know, check out this video. It's pretty cool. And it would be nice if we could just kind of start it and watch it together.
Right.
So
what's cool about SyncTube is it gives you sort of a chat interface so you can chat with all the people. Below it, it shows you all the viewers. It shows their sort of buffering level and whether or not they're synced. We did test it, and what we found was that there's like a second delay, 1 or 2 yeah. seconds. And that totally makes sense because if you think about it, I mean, there is going to be some millisecond delay between the app saying, you know, oh, I started, hit play now. Mm-hmm. I started this position. So I think, and you can create playlists so that you can just keep watching a whole playlist of small YouTube, because YouTube tends to be smaller videos. It's not like a movie. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you can find, maybe I'm, you know, getting in trouble. You can find sort of episodes or movies that are in sort of different chunks. So the playlist is kind of nice for that. So if you find, you know, this TV episode, part 1 of 5, you can link up all 5 and then mm-hmm. watch them.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to do that. Copyright infringement is bad. Don't do it.
You could also use this in like an office setting, get 5 people together, watch like a Google University talk or something.
Oh yeah. I didn't even think of that.
You know, it allows like 5 or 6 people. I saw the little icons yeah. for, so, you know, you could queue it up and everyone can watch it and kind of take notes and chat. Cause there's a little chat box
totally.
On the right side. So,
yeah. I'm not a huge YouTuber, I guess I wouldn't say yeah. I'm not, but this really sort of, you know, I was interested because, we had this problem at one point with a different video service, but it, you know, I think a lot of people out there, YouTube is kind of the lost social network for me. I think there is a lot of traffic and a lot of social networking that goes on YouTube, but I, for some reason, it never did hit me. And it amazes me to watch, like, there's video podcasts on there that are huge, you know, with tons of views, millions of views every day that started and only exist really on YouTube.
Do you use other video services? Or do you just not use the video aspect?
I just don't watch a whole lot of videos online. I mean, if I'm reading an article that has like an interesting video, like a talk or something, yeah, mm-hmm. I watch it. But I don't ever just like, I want to go to YouTube and browse around, which I think a lot of, especially sort of the younger generation, do a lot of.
Yeah.
All right. Do you use YouTube a lot, Eric?
Well, actually, our business uses YouTube quite a lot, just for viewing, you know, maybe tech talks and things. And right. so it's kind of an interesting application that, you know, this SyncTube is nice because it's free, and, you know, small businesses could maybe keep their different offices watching the same thing at the same time in sync, and they don't have to pay for a service like ReadyTalk or something right. like that.
Oh, yeah.
Although this does much less, it's kind of an interesting idea, and, you know, it has its uses for smaller clients.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah, especially if you have, I mean, that's a great application if you have a distributed office. and you're like, hey, let's watch, you know, this conference talk on this product that we're thinking of using, you know, together, or like kind of a, you know, if there's webinar videos on YouTube, it does suck because it is only YouTube and there are other video services out there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that was SyncTube. I think I just thought it was fun because we've done that before. So our next web app, and this one kind of has an interesting story behind it. The reason I brought it up was because, so about 6 months ago or so, I was talking with Mark and a bunch of my other friends because I had an idea for a charity. And I thought, you know, I was looking at how there's always little change bowls, you know, next to counters, like at a convenience store, mm-hmm. you know, where if people get like a couple cents change, they, you know, you give a penny, take a penny. And so it made me think of, you know, it's so funny that I like round dollars. I don't like the $3.99 stuff. I would rather just pay $4. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, like, it would be cool if there was like a donation service out there or a nonprofit where the whole point was you donated your change from a transaction. So every transaction was rounded up to the dollar and you donated them. And so I started talking to people. And really, the funny part was, is I thought, well, you either have to get, you know, like merchant buy-in or like credit card buy-in or bank buy-in, right? And then you'd have to get, if you really wanted to do it, you'd have to get them all because you can't expect people to change their credit card or their mm-hmm. bank. And so I kind of give up on the idea because it just seemed too big. So our next web app is SwipeGood, which is exactly that. Except for they took, I think they took a more clever look at how to implement it than I did, because they were, you know, I was looking at these big sort of infrastructure changes like, oh, you'd have to get a store to do it. What they did is they just connect to and download your purchases and then just take those purchases and take the amount to round it up to the nearest dollar and then sort of process and charge you that amount at the end of a month, you know, all those added up, and then you can donate them to this particular one is donorschoose.org, which is a way to donate to different classroom projects. But I mean, I thought it was funny because Paul Levette at work was like, hey, wasn't this kind of that idea you were talking about 6 months yep. ago? And it exists and it's out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, you wanted to do the big infrastructure, like let's take 20 cents out on this transaction, make these little micro payments. But this is a clever idea to just grab up all of them, make mm-hmm. a total and say, okay, $20 this month or $5 this month goes to, and then DonorsChoose.org, I assume you can choose the party or place you want.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting, this is almost like a whole nother web app, but there's teachers and like schools, they put up projects that they need money for. Like, oh, I want to get a new, you know, a new interactive projector or something for my classroom, and it's going to take, you know, $6,000. And what you do is your donor choose balance, you can just sort of choose which project you want to donate and how much money you want to donate it to, and then it can go to that. So you can see like, you know, which projects are almost finished and then, you know, donate, you know, like $100 to those guys and help them finish their project. And it's really about helping education, which is cool because that's, I mean, I'm all for that. So I thought it was interesting that they chose that as their donation thing too.
Would you use SwipeGood, Eric?
Well, actually, I was checking it out and I couldn't bring myself to enroll because it seems like you enroll your credit card with this service and you also connect it with Facebook. And the whole thing just kind of screams like things that people who are skittish like I might be about, you know, this kind of information just kind of gets into a bit of a privacy issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. And that's great because I didn't think of that at all. You know, it was something that I was like, man, I should just sign up for this. That's great. But yeah, I mean, you do need to recognize that you are authorizing this service to see every transaction that happens to happens on your card, and it's I mean, you would hope, I mean, let's say hope, that they're just looking at the value of each transaction and rounding it up, but they could not be as well. They could also be, you know, storing every purchase and selling that information you know, to companies for looking at, you know, potential information on how to help get consumers to buy more stuff.
So one thing I noticed, you know, they probably don't have malicious intent, but one thing that I kind of notice is they don't have kind of their security policy or any of that.
Very true.
You have to connect to Facebook and enroll before you can even.
Well, you don't have to connect to Facebook. In their defense, you can create an account without connecting to Facebook.
Okay. So, well, I guess what I meant is I don't see any place where I can check out what their security policies are. And I mean, they have a privacy section, but.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to, you know how like when you go to Mint, they're like all about the security. They're like,
right.
You know, we use this special service that, you know, connects to your bank. We don't have anything to do with it. We, you know, do this and that. And, you know, it gives you that feeling. It's like, when I can trust the service, like, you know, a little bit more because they're pretty serious about security. Whereas this, I don't know anything until maybe maybe if I log in, I get to.
Well, and I think it just depends on certain people too. Like, so there was a service that I got a beta for a while ago called Blippi, and the whole point of Blippi is it is a purchase social network. So it attaches to a credit card or a debit card, and the whole point is it sort of broadcasts out your purchases to your friends. And so, I think it just depends on particular things. Like, I'm okay with people seeing what I purchased with my credit card. I know, like, you know, Leo Laporte was talking about Blippi, and he was like, I love it. I think it's a great idea. And a lot of people have found cool things by seeing what people they like and admire have bought. Mm-hmm. I ended up not using the service and discontinuing my account because it just was like another social network I didn't need to pay attention to. But, like, for example, I mean, I'm just not really skittish about letting people see what I purchase on my credit card. Just and some people are. I guess I'm just sort of not like I don't really I'm not concerned about privacy for. Well, that's a difficult thing to say. Yeah, I'm not very private about my purchases. In fact, I usually like to tell. Yeah, I mean that's why I did the geek tools because I want to tell people about cool stuff that I'm looking at buying or things I bought. Mm-hmm. But some people are, and I totally understand that.
Yeah, I loved Blippi to watch what other people were buying, but I kind of didn't want to put my stuff up. I think I put Netflix because you could say what movies you're watching.
Yeah.
I think I did that, and that was about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the idea is interesting, but maybe just a bit idealistic with how it works.
Yeah.
Perhaps if they, you know, do something else where it's kind of they're working with the credit card vendors themselves directly, then that would kind of make it better, kind of like Mint does.
Right.
They work directly with the banks.
Yeah, I think
it's kind of like very third party, and I'm like, I'm not sure what's happening in the background and how it works.
Right, and you know, SwipeGrid, they might be doing the same thing that Mint use, you know, does to connect with the banks. We don't know.
I heard about this with Blippi. They were talking about there's basically one. There's like one company on the web out there that does like all the like bank and credit card connecting stuff for most of the big ones, and that's how Blippi got it. And so like I would assume they probably use the same service. I sort of
Mint and Blippi and a few others, they use that same service and they have all your information anyways, so
yeah, I see. When I was talking about it, Eric, that was kind of my thought too, because well, there's other things too, is that I don't like to be sort of processed at the end of the month. I thought the reason I thought this donation system would work is that you look at your credit card and you were literally charged $4 and you say, okay, I went to this coffee shop, I was charged $4 rather than charged $3.80 and then once a month getting like a bill for you know, $60 that I need, you know, even though it's not a bill, it's for donations. But, you know, for me, like the whole working with the credit card processors to have it happen as it happens. And the whole point is the user needs to kind of be oblivious to it. Like rather than being a coffee for $3.80, it's a coffee for $4. And then just like, hey, you have $60 to donate to people at the end of the month. I thought that was sort of the crux of the system really working for me.
Fair enough.
All right, well, that was SwipeGrid. I want to remind you guys, if you have some news, a follow-up, or web application you think we should look at, let us know by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. We'd love to talk about what you guys would like us to, so let us know. All right, and with that, let's get into Hadoop. Eric, what is Hadoop?
Okay, well, guys, Hadoop is basically a group of Apache projects centered around developing highly scalable and distributed applications. So the basic idea is that, say you have a large data set, like a trillion tweets, and you store them in a distributed way on a group of machines that we can call a Hadoop cluster. And you would then write a program and submit it to Hadoop, which then automatically distributes it to the cluster and runs your program in parallel on all of the machines. And then you get your results back. And it's the idea is that it scales linearly as opposed to many database applications that scale kind of exponentially.
Cool. Yeah. Do you have to write, when you're writing the program, do you have to kind of keep in mind that it's going to be distributed, or does it take care of that for you? Or
You kind of have to know what the MapReduce algorithm that's being run by Hadoop does kind of the scaling for you.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to know its constraints. You want to work with data that is not normalized. So log data is really good. You know, things that where you have like say a date and an IP, in every on every line is ideal, because you don't want to have to go look that up. You want it right there for your program to process.
So, Eric, you've mentioned this MapReduce a couple times now. What exactly is that?
So MapReduce is basically a patented software framework introduced by Google sometime or like in the early 2000s. And basically what it describes is an algorithm that has two major steps, a map and reduce. The map step basically just takes a list and key, some keys and values, and produces a, another list of keys and values in a sorted order. And then it partitions the data in such a way that it can be distributed out to the, you know, other nodes in for the reduce phase.
Okay. Is this kind of like, I mean, it sounds to be kind of like almost like a database index, where it sort of takes the data, compiles it into like a sort of recognizable list of, like, you know, if it's sorted a particular way, you know how to get to it, and then kind of makes an index to it?
No, not quite. Okay. What it does is it takes all of the data and it does sort it, but it doesn't add any indexing to it. The whole idea behind sorting by a key is that you want all of your keys to go to the same reducer.
Oh, okay.
So say say I'm processing log data, for example. I want data for the same IP to go to be processed so I can see all the things that that IP did.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
That totally makes sense.
In essence, going all to the same reducer so it can say, okay, so for all the things that this IP did, you know, it did this at this time and this other thing at this time, and, you know, and then you pick the things you care about and calculate them.
So I know Python has a function called map, right? Is that related to this at all? Or?
That's actually these things, map and reduce functions are common in functional programming. So Python's a good example, but yeah, you have, you know, these same kinds of constructs in Ruby, Erlang, etc.
Okay, cool. So can you give us some examples of where it would be useful?
Sure. So to start off, I should explain that a lot of companies are using Hadoop. You know, obviously Google is, but, you know, Netflix is using it for, say, recommendations of movies, Amazon for recommendations of what you might buy. You know, other companies will be, you know, creating these contextual ads based on what other users have purchased.
Totally.
They'll show a different ad. You know, you can use it for search and search indexes, processing, you know, a large number of images, analyzing your web server logs. You know, you could sort very large sets of data. In fact, Yahoo, I think, was posting results recently that sort a terabyte of data in under 1 minute.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, I saw an example on Wikipedia that said the New York Times processed 4 terabytes of images and into 11 million finished PDFs, and it cost them $240 is all, and they did it in 24 hours.
So, not surprising.
So these companies like Amazon and Netflix are doing this with recommendations. If they didn't have kind of a cluster, is this something that would take just, you know, months to run if you didn't have something like Hadoop?
Well, it depends on how you approach the problem. You might be able to approach it in a different way that doesn't quite take months. Or you might just resolve yourself to not getting the same quality of results you can get.
Yeah.
But yes, if you had one single computer do it, it might take to the end of time or something. Or if you tried to task an Oracle database or something, you know, it might never finish.
Totally. Sure. But one of the keys is that it has to be sort of non-normalized data, data that just kind of stands alone by itself.
Right. That's exactly right. You know, it's not the same paradigm as a relational database where normalization is something that you want.
This is kind of shooting from the hip, I think. Does this work really well with... So you were saying, I mean, I was looking at Hadoop and it kind of has, it does its own data store, right? There's a Hadoop sort of distributed data store, correct?
So Hadoop Common includes a distributed file system called HDFS. And basically what it is just a file system that is available across all of the nodes, and the data is stored on all of the nodes. And when I say node, I mean any machine that is not the name node or master node, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay. No, so there's a master node, and then there's all these sort of, you know, smaller nodes that get data distributed to it. And then I'm assuming jobs distributed to it based on the data on it?
Say that one more time.
So when you send a job through Hadoop, does it only process, because it does have this distributed file system, does it only work on the data on it? Is that kind of how it's like, hey, you have this data on it, this is a job related to that data, work on that stuff you have locally?
So it's kind of an interesting problem you ask about, because HDFS actually keeps three copies of most data by default on different machines, and it will shuffle where it needs to, but it tries to, you know, it has optimizations for rack locality, and so that it knows, you know, hey, I am a server and I have another server that's on the same rack, and I want to get the data from that one before I, you know, try to look elsewhere.
Oh, right.
So it's actually rack aware. There's lots of optimizations that are baked into Hadoop that just completely go unnoticed.
Oh, wow.
Unless you really dig in, and you almost never have trouble with them. They're so under the covers.
Well, that's nice if it's rack aware too, for sort of like disaster recovery type stuff, because if you know you have at least, you know, if it takes three copies and you have at least one copy on another rack elsewhere, you know, if an earthquake takes out the one building, at least you still have, you know, it knows to at least keep one copy off on another rack.
So Hadoop is designed to be scalable in by commodity hardware that is, you know, planning for failure.
Great.
Because these machines are going to fail, and you don't want it to be catastrophic if a node goes down.
Yeah,
makes sense.
The idea is that, you know, you have one server in 100, you know, eat its own hard drive or whatever, and, you know, therefore the job is largely unaffected. Because you still have 99 other nodes and two other copies of whatever data you might be looking for.
So this sounds really great for, you know, Amazon and Netflix. Is it? I mean, it sounds like it's, you know, there might be like a lot of setup to get this going. Is it really hard to get it going? Do you make a cluster?
To make a meaningful Hadoop cluster, it is actually a decent amount of work, because you have to install, you know, all the various tools that you want, Hadoop, perhaps Hive or Zookeeper or whatever, on each of these machines. You have to allocate a job tracker node, a name node, and they could be the same machine. But it takes a decent amount of technical knowledge, which is why a lot of people that don't have, you know, don't want to go through this setup use like a service like Amazon's Elastic MapReduce, mm-hmm. that has everything set up for you, and you just provide the program and the data via Amazon's S3. And it just does it all for you.
Oh, wow.
And it's actually pretty cheap too. I know a lot of, you know, startups that will just use Amazon's services, mm-hmm. web services, just because it's the most economical choice. You know, they don't want to buy a large database machine, but their job is too big for perhaps, you know, MySQL or their own one machine.
Yeah, I mean, if they buy their own and have their own servers, and, you know, then they have to upgrade a year or two later and then buy brand new machines and everything.
Yeah, it's just if you're a startup, you usually don't have, you know, I mean, I'm assuming that to have sort of, like you said, a useful Hadoop cluster, there is probably at least a bare minimum set of machines, right?
Mm-hmm. You probably, I mean, you know, we've worked with machines of four machines, four machine size clusters, which is fine, but it's only really not going to be all that, you know, performant.
Right.
All right. So let's say I have a small to medium sized business and I have a lot of data to go through. How can I take advantage of Hadoop?
Well, first thing I should mention is that Hadoop is designed to run on commodity hardware that you can buy anywhere. So it's actually pretty cheap. And so, you know, the advantage to this approach is that you can keep all of your data around, you know, things that you might have otherwise had to throw away because, you know, your Oracle database or whatever just can't handle it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also, you know, you can scale much more easily. You just add more cheap servers. So how a medium or small sized business would probably, you know, take advantage of such an infrastructure if they built their own, say they hire someone and that can just administer these things, mm-hmm. And they build their own small cluster. You know, the nice thing is you load all your data onto it, and then you can install a project like Hive and use SQL-like queries to query this massive data set dynamically. And it actually just creates a MapReduce job on the fly runs it.
That is way cool, actually.
You know, your analysts can get their answers back without knowing, you know, real programming.
Right, yeah, and you don't. It's not like I have to like go through all the different nodes in the cluster and look for my data. You can just set a query and get it all.
Right, so, exactly. And another nice thing is that, you know, different groups can use this, you know, together. There's different schedulers available for Hadoop. So, you know, you can ask for things and then have them in some sort of queue so that the Hadoop cluster itself is shared fairly across, you know, all the different departments of your organization.
So I assume Hadoop doesn't completely replace the Oracle type databases. I mean, is there things that you should not use Hadoop for?
So I'd like to mention what I'm going to call my rule of 1 million. you have to have a million things of something to process for it to be meaningfully done with Hadoop.
Okay.
You know, you have to have a million tweets, a million images, a million users. Because Hadoop really isn't best for small applications. The whole idea of it is massive scalability.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's cheap, especially once you get it running, you know, it's also not going to be useful for, you know, very for queries that take a lot of dynamic processing, so or indexes, say.
Those would be more suited for like a database.
Databases are still better for, you know, things where you have lots of joins.
Right.
You know, because you can't really join anything in Hadoop. there is a project called HBase that has, you know, some indexing capabilities. And I'm actually currently using to serve up, you know, pages much, much faster than any other database could possibly do. But thing is that you have to know in advance and know you have to actually structure your tables as it were in such a way that they can be queried simply and without joins.
Right.
So combining the data is more difficult and still doable by Hive and things, but it's just not going to be very fast. So there's still things, you know, that you'll really need your MySQLs for.
Okay.
But the bottom line is don't use it for small applications, or at least not with that intent, because that's not going to suit your needs.
So let's say I'm convinced of Hadoop and I want to try it out. How do I get started?
So the first thing I would try and consider is, you know, check out Amazon's web services and especially their Elastic MapReduce. It's horribly cheap to, you know, a small machine in an Elastic MapReduce cluster is 1.5 cents per hour.
Wow.
And so you can spin up 100 machines for $1.50 an hour.
Wow. So you don't have to go buy 150 machines and set up your own and administer and stuff. That's awesome. That's really cheap.
And it takes care of it all for you. You still have to pay for Amazon S3, which is also like, I don't know, 2 cents per gig per month or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculously cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And usually you only have to rent the cluster for an hour or two.
Uh-huh. Right. It seems like for the smaller guys, this is probably the way to go, you know, instead of buying all these machines, unless you had machines just laying around.
Yeah, but even then, it's not, you know, trivial to set it up.
Yeah.
It would be enough work that you might as well just try it out and see if you can kind of make MapReduce fit your needs.
Right.
I mean, try out Amazon Elastic MapReduce, or, you know, Amazon should be paying me for all that I'm mentioning. They're not. I haven't heard of a good, reasonable competing product.
Right. So can you write this stuff in any language, or, I mean?
So Hadoop is written in Java, but there's no reason that you can't use a feature called Hadoop Streaming with, say, Perl or Shell Script or Ruby And there's also hooks for C++.
Cool.
Using Hadoop pipes. Okay. So there's actually a lot of platforms supported. And if you, you know, depending on what you know, there's probably a solution available for you. And even with the other projects like Hive and HBase, there are Thrift APIs that let you communicate with these other tools, you know, through most any popular language.
Oh, cool. So I could just sort of use that. I could use just Hive to get data from it and not really have to like send my jobs out through Hadoop. It could just be like my front end trying to grab data from it. So like if I used it for collecting and processing logs, I could still use, like a Ruby on Rails front end to grab that data and just display log information.
Right. But I don't think Rails is quite right. You'd just want like a small Ruby script that with a map and reduce function.
Ah, okay.
And then, you know, you would say Hadoop jar, use this Hadoop streaming jar, and then, you know, you pass it basically anything that runs on the command line and then tell it to run this as a mapper, this as a reducer, and this is, you know, there's a bunch of options like how many reduce tasks you want, et cetera, and where you want the output to be stored.
Eric, is there a way to test the functions before you, you know, send them out to the army of machines? Is there kind of a way to see what you're going to, a little snippet of what you're going to get back or anything, or if it's even going to work?
Yeah, actually, so depending on how you do it, I mean, so these are just simple Java or Python or whatever programs, and to emulate a simple MapReduce job on the command line, you just would, you know, say cat a file to your mapper function and then pipe it to sort and then pipe that to, you know, something that runs your reduce function, and then you're done. Like that basically emulates an entire, MapReduce. That's mostly all it is on a small scale.
I see. So you can kind of do it on your own little machine before you send it out.
Right. Awesome. But realistically, you'll probably want to write unit tests or things like that to catch these cases that you'll have inherent in such huge data sets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that. Cool. Well, so I guess thank you, Eric, for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. Do you have any shout outs or links or anything that you want to send people to before we head out?
All right. So if you're interested in Hadoop, go to hadoop.apache.org and download, you know, the binaries. It's free. It's open source. There's a lot of documentation and a lot of examples. It's been around for a while. You'll find that there are a lot of interesting little applications that you can do if you think of, you know, if you think about your problem in such a way that it can be scalable.
And where can we find information about you, Eric?
So you can find me on Twitter at Erwin, and I also blog about some geeky things at erwin.com.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to thank Eric for coming on the show. Hadoop sounds really cool. I'll have to play around with it. It definitely might be very applicable where I work, on campus. So I'm going to have to check it out and bone up on my MapReduce. I want to remind you, everybody, that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. And you can also leave feedback for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Thank you for listening, everybody. We really appreciate it. And we will see you next week.